We're going to cross Pakistan's eastern border now for a story out of northern India, where traditional values are clashing with modern mores. There's been a reported upsurge in honor killings. Those are the murders of young couples who elope in defiance of caste boundaries and their families' wishes. The struggle pits traditional village councils against reformers trying to promote freedom of marriage, as well as the Indian government trying to keep traditional values within the bounds of the law. NPR's Corey Flintoff has the story from New Delhi.
There's no more joyous celebration in India than a marriage, the central institution that unites extended families and fulfills the society's strongest values. But there's a dark side. Nearly every day, Indian media carry reports like this one on Delhi's NewsX channel on the murders of young people who tried to defy very specific local rules about who can marry whom.
Delhi's New Friends Colony woke up to a shock this morning. A couple was found murdered in a suspected case of dishonor killing. The man's body bore strangulation marks, while the woman was found tied and frothing at the mouth. The girl's father and the guard of the building have been arrested.
In northern India, the prohibitions usually involve couples who marry outside their caste or their bloodlines, a complicated system of lineage called a gotra. In rural areas, they're enforced by informal councils of village elders called kap panchayats. This is a farmer's house in Maicha, a village a little over an hour's drive from New Delhi. It's in the middle of peaceful and prosperous rice paddies and cornfields, where cars and motorcycles share the roads with bullock carts, and children lead their water buffaloes to cool off in the river. It's also the scene of a potentially deadly dispute, where a young woman from this family has eloped with a young man from another village who's of a slightly lower caste. The young woman's father and uncle say they've been falsely accused of threatening violence if the young woman isn't returned. The father thinks his daughter was pressured into running away, and he says he just wants to hear from her that this is what she wants.
I hate to ask you this about your own daughter, but would you kill her if you felt that your honor or your family's honor had been harmed?
No, he says, I would never harm my daughter. If she tells me that she wants to stay with the boy, I'll let her do that. This is Daula, the village where the young man's family lives. The young man's father and uncle say they feel their lives are threatened. They charge that the council of elders, the kap panchayat from the young woman's village, demanded one of their village girls in exchange for the woman who eloped. They say they're searching for the missing couple but haven't been able to find them. Too often, young people involved in elopements are eventually found dead, victims of murder or mutual suicides. The danger has spurred social activists to offer to help newly eloped couples. Sanjoy Suchdev heads a group in New Delhi calling itself the Love Commandos. Suchdev meets us on a rooftop in central Delhi. He says he keeps the location of his office secret because he's received death threats for resisting violence against young couples.
Which people call honor killing, but we feel it is a national disgrace. In this great country of love, there is so much hate against love and love marriage. We are flooded with calls.
He says his group of volunteers includes lawyers and counselors who can help eloped couples marry and find shelter from relatives who might do them harm. Swami Agnivesh, a social reformer, says Indian politicians need to take a firm stand against village councils that advocate violence or forced marriage.
And they just do not want to stand up and tell these so-called village elders that rubbish, you stop this nonsense, otherwise you will be tried for murder.
But Madhu Kishwar, a women's rights activist, says these traditional councils deserve some respect and understanding.
Nobody goes, talks to those people, try to understand what their concerns are, what is the moral universe that they come from, including those who otherwise want to celebrate India's diversity and insist that there shouldn't be one-size-fits-all kind of society.
Kishwar says that murder and intimidation ought to be punished, no matter what the cause. But she says the kap panchayats can be a force for stability in villages and safety for women. Lawmakers are weighing in as well. Some members of India's parliament have introduced bills that would give local councils more of a say in restrictions on marriage. while others are pressing for stronger penalties against those who advocate violence. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, New Delhi.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Next to Tell Me More's weekly conversation, Faith Matters, when the focus is on matters of faith and spirituality. Today we continue our occasional series on women and faith with a story about Judaism's most holy site, the Western Wall in Jerusalem. Thousands of Jewish pilgrims visit the sacred spot, also known as the Wailing Wall, every year to pray and reflect. But Israeli law imposes limits on the way women can express their faith at the stone structure, a remnant of the ancient site of the original Jewish temple. For years, a debate over that law has raged among Jews in Israel and around the world. Many call the restrictions antiquated and sexist. Others deem the rules necessary to uphold Orthodox values. Earlier this month, Reform activist Anat Hoffman, who leads a group called Women of the Wall, intentionally defied the rules, openly carrying a Torah, although not reading from it, near the wall while leading a procession of women in song. Israeli police arrested Hoffman. She was fined and banned from the wall for a month. Ms. Hoffman joins us now from our New York bureau. Welcome to Tell Me More.
Yes, shalom. Millions come to the wall every year. Thousands a day.
And when you visited on July 12th, did you intend to get arrested?
I intended to challenge the powers that be on an issue that was not yet clear. We were carrying the scroll to the wall for the last 21 years, except we always carry it in a duffel bag. In the last 8 months, the chief of police has decided, without any explanation, to confiscate the Torah scroll from us as we enter in the morning and stash it in the back of his car. We found that not very respectful of the book and of the whole occasion, and we decided that as there are 200 Torah scrolls in the men's side, completely available for free to men's use, and ours is the only one for women's use, we decided that we will carry it outside the duffel bag, holding it in our arms. That caused the police to be worried about safety and security because the bullies, the ultra-Orthodox bullies at the wall, might attack the women for holding a Sefer Torah.
Well, we should clarify that it's not against the law of the Israeli Supreme Court. It challenges the traditional norms of the ultra-Orthodox.
The Supreme Court ordered that women cannot read from the Torah at the Western Wall. Women were allocated to the tune of almost 6 million shekel in an alternate site. You in America know this as separate but equal. We were given another wall. Why? There are many walls in Jerusalem. Why stick to this one? There's a wall in my house. I'm surprised the Israeli government didn't, in its benevolence, order that I would pray in my own living room. We were given another site. I was walking with the Sefer Torah from the site where I'm forbidden to read to a site where I'm allowed to read. The court did not give an opinion over carrying a Sefer Torah. I run an organization, the Israel Religious Action Center, which is the legal and political arm of the Reform Movement. I have many lawyers, and I came armed with quite a few legal opinions saying that carrying the Torah is legal. However, the wild card here is violence. It's because of violence that the police decided to take me to prison and not stop some of the people who are attacking. Instead of dealing with the bullies, they deal with the minority.
By bullies, you mean the ultra-Orthodox?
Ultra-Orthodox men and women who decide that they will enforce their way of belief at the wall by using violence.
Now, the publicity from your arrest has highlighted what could be a significant rift between the direction of Jewish law in Israel and the diaspora, particularly here in the U.S. You're in the U.S. now. What role do you think American Jews play in this debate?
This is an excellent question. I just want to add one more thing. Most Israeli Jews are not Orthodox either. Not Israeli Jews, not Jews in the diaspora. The Orthodox are a minority in the Jewish world, and yet they dictate life choices in Israel, not just at the wall. At the wall, it's very pronounced, but it's in the issues of conversion, of burial, of marriage, and a variety of other issues. The segregated buses in Israel, I don't know if you're aware that there are 106 segregated buses run by our state bus company, where women are assigned to the back and men to the front. There are 2,500 rides like that every day. We're in the Supreme Court challenging this, representing Orthodox women. It is Orthodox women that are objecting to the segregated buses. And let me tell you another thing. The women of the wall are, in the majority, Orthodox women. The most courageous feminists I know are Orthodox women challenging Orthodoxy from within.
And where do you think, you mentioned the conversion law, which is a debate that has been postponed but not taken care of. That is a debate particularly that American Jews have gotten involved with. Where do you think this is headed? What role do you think is going to form between the diaspora and the ultra-Orthodox in Israel?
Well, hopefully, and that is my wish, that Jews all over the world will understand that Israel is way too important to be left to the Israelis.
If Israel's too important to be left to the Israelis, who should it be left to?
I think the Jewish people have to discuss what are the values, what are Jewish values that govern a sovereign Jewish state? What are these values? Are these values of tolerance, of pluralism, of openness, of equality, or the opposite of that? And I think that Jews of the world have a voice in this, and I'm delighted that with the unfortunate conversion bill, but we heard that voice. The giant has awakened. Jews from Australia and Jews from Europe and Jews of North America have made it very clear to the powers that be in Israel. Jews have never had a pope, and there's a good reason for it. We're an argumentative bunch by definition. If you read the Bible, it's one long litany of us arguing with each other, with God, with the kings, with Moses, with everyone is resigning, everyone is throwing his hands up saying, oh, I hate these people, I can't stand them anymore. And it's still like this today. We are a culture of argument, and we are great at debate. And I refuse to accept that in the Jewish state there will be one way to be Jewish, and that way is Orthodoxy.
Anat Hoffman, chairwoman of Women of the Wall. She's also the executive director of the Israel Religious Action Center, which advocates for the reform movement in Israel. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Shalom.
Arizona's controversial immigration law went into effect last week, but it wasn't the law the state wanted. On Wednesday, a federal judge blocked key provisions, including one that requires the police to check the immigration status of all suspects. Despite significant support for the bill in Arizona, its critics have been loud and organized. A big part of that support has come from the religious community. From member station KJZZ, Peter O'Dowd has more.
When Arizona's legislature passed SB 1070 in April, a prayer vigil began outside the House of Representatives. For 102 consecutive days, members of various church communities were a constant presence outside the building. It was no different on Wednesday morning when the federal ruling came down. Word of the judge's decision trickled through the crowd as a Catholic priest gave Mass. Whispers grew into smiles, smiles into audible cries of joy. Wiping away tears, Nicole Torres said this is just the beginning.
We're going to continue the next part of our campaign, of our plan, which is to register as many unregistered voters in Maricopa County, Arizona, that we can, make sure they go out to the polls in November, and really hold the elected officials who thought this was okay accountable.
Recently in Arizona, this line between politics and prayer is crossed nearly every time demonstrators gather. Since April, marches have commonly started or ended at a local church. On the day the watered-down law went into effect, demonstrations against it still went ahead, beginning here at the Episcopal Trinity Cathedral. Religious leaders and politicians stood in the pulpit and roused about 400 people to continue the fight.
Christ going to the cross was the very presence of a brown man being sent to the execution chamber on some trumped-up charges.
This is Priscilla Austin. She's a vicar at a local Lutheran church who says the merger of religion, justice, and politics goes way back to the beginning of Christianity. Austin says modern politics has forced her congregation into hiding. Attendance has been cut in half at Hispanic prayer services since Arizona's immigration controversy began. Nearby Episcopal and Catholic churches report similar drops. Austin believes people are afraid to be in public.
We find that there is now an opportunity to continue to stand alongside our Latino brothers and sisters. The church is here for them and with them.
Churches benefit by keeping Latinos happy and in the pews. That's according to Elaine Eklund. She studies religion and politics at Rice University.
They're fundamental to religious life in American society right now.
Eklund says nearly 70% of Hispanics in the U.S. are Catholic.
This is a huge constituency in the church that's keeping the American church alive, really, and thriving.
Eklund says this applies to all denominations. The conservative evangelical movement is also pushing for comprehensive immigration reform. Reverend Samuel Rodriguez leads the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference. He says evangelicals are involved first to protect human rights and then to bolster congregations.
It's the fastest growing component of many of our churches. So we're looking at the very viability, survivability, and sustainability of the Latino evangelical community lies embedded in the immigration reform debate.
We don't believe that any person can change the rules of God.
Anna Durand is 27. She was born in Mexico and now has a green card. In downtown Phoenix this week, she joined about 200 other protesters against the immigration law from Trinity Cathedral. Some held crucifixes. Others held a portrait of the Virgin Mary and Pope John Paul II.
We know we haven't won yet. We know this is just a little piece of what we want. But we're still going to continue to be praying.
The protesters, including clergy from several denominations, walked to the federal courthouse. Some were arrested and held overnight. For NPR News, I'm Peter O'Dowd.